Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. This weekend, the country was confronted with back-to-back mass shootings, one of which was explicitly tied to white nationalist terrorism. A young man targeting immigrants killed 20 people at an El Paso Walmart on Saturday. That attack is being investigated as domestic terrorism. Another 9 people were killed in Dayton, Ohio on Sunday in a shooting where the motive is still unknown. At least 53 people were wounded in those 2 attacks, and another 7 people were wounded in a shooting in Chicago, also on Sunday. So today, we're going to take a look at the trends in mass shootings and white nationalism, how politicians are responding, and what the American public thinks. And here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Also here with me is senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How are you?
Hey, Galen.
And managing editor, Micah Cohen. Hey there.
Hello.
Later in the show, we're also going to check out the post-debate Democratic primary polling and see if anything has really changed in that race. We're also going to take stock of Republican retirements in the House so far this year. The number of retirements rose to 9 today after Texas Congressman Kenny Marchant said that he's leaving Congress. Also, another Texan and the lone black Republican in the House, Will Hurd, announced his retirement last Thursday. But let's begin with the events of this past weekend. So I mentioned some of what we know about the attacks, and law enforcement investigations are still being conducted. But at this point, what else is notable about the attacks that happened this weekend? Claire, let's start with you.
Well, I think given that we're on a political podcast, I think the mass shooting that stands out to me the most in that context, and I realize that that's a pretty macabre phrasing, and I don't mean to be flip about it, but the El Paso shooting at a Walmart that is frequented by people from Juarez in Mexico, as well as by American citizens. The shooter posted on an online forum white supremacist theories about demographics, specifically about, you know, Latinos and whites being replaced. And he quoted Trump reportedly quite a few times. Now, I actually can't read the manifesto anymore on its original forum. The link doesn't actually open for me, so I'm assuming that it has been taken down, but those are reports about it.
So he didn't I read the manifesto. He didn't explicitly quote Trump, and he kind of goes out of his way to say, I had these beliefs before Trump got into office, and we can debate whether or not that's true. And there's also complicated issues surrounding how much to specifically refer to this manifesto, because sure, it was written to manipulate the media. Anyway, he doesn't explicitly quote Trump. There are obvious themes
in that document
that have been brought up in Fox News and by Trump, etc.
Sure. Anyway, the geographic location of the shooting, the fact that El Paso has been at the center of, you know, a lot of back and forth rhetorical attacks, mostly from the president. And you've seen, you know, there's former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who's obviously from El Paso, who this morning, we're recording this on Monday late morning, you know, this morning basically came out and said to a media gaggle, listen, guys, of course, the president's rhetoric is connected to the shooting, and made some pretty strong statements. So it's unfortunately part of the political conversation.
That's what stands out to me. And some of this will echo what Claire said. But this has become a thing in the U.S. now where we have these mass shootings, and then there is always a political conversation that follows. And that conversation has different flavors and different tenors and focuses on different things depending on the specifics of the shooting, right? What stands out in this case is just how snugly fit this tragedy was within our politics. I mean, the language that the shooter used in what he wrote, as you guys said, echoes what Trump has said, echoes Fox News. You know, the point about it predating Trump, that doesn't disconnect the two. We have research that shows that the way that political rhetoric can affect violence is not by making someone who has never had these thoughts before all of a sudden adopt them, right? It's by focusing and activating people who already believe some of this stuff. So to me, it's like, it's just sort of how closely tied the two feel that stands out.
What I keep on thinking about is, if people remember when Congressman Gabby Giffords was shot in a parking lot along with several other people several years ago, there was a conversation that said, you know, there had been, I guess, some sort of, these are the districts to target right?
That, it was a Sarah Palin.
Yeah, right? Sarah Palin led kind of, these are the, and Gifford's district was one of them. These are the districts we want to target to like turn over, right? To make it to into Republican districts. And initially there was a lot of people saying, look, you put, you know, a gun crosshairs on these posters and someone actually shot this congresswoman. These things are connected. And then there was a pushback in the media to say, no, that's those things aren't connected. And I think, listen, I'm not here to talk about that shooting necessarily, but I think that the fact that we're having a pretty explicit conversation in 2019 about the way political rhetoric can incite violence is very, very different. And, you know, people constantly make references to the language that Trump uses about an infestation or you know, those
invasion.
Yeah. An invasion. Yeah. And I think it's, in light of this weekend's events, it is really striking to go back and look at the way we as a culture, a media, a political system reacted to the Gifford shooting versus the way we're reacting to now. And I don't think we're reacting to it wrong now, to tie political rhetoric to violence. And they're, you know, I think that they are likely going to treat this shooting as a incident of domestic terrorism and B, a hate crime.
Yeah. And I do want, since we're talking about the relationship between rhetoric and violence, I want to quote an article from Nathan Calmo, who's an assistant professor of political communications at Louisiana State University. He wrote an article in Politico last October titled, "Yes, Political Rhetoric Can Incite Violence." And here's his quote. "Researchers have good circumstantial evidence from the real world, as well as evidence from scientific experiments concluding overall that rhetoric is probably not the main cause in most attacks, but violent, hateful language can inflame people who are already inclined toward violence and focus their rage." So something to keep in mind throughout this conversation. Nate, to put this in context, what do we know about the incidences of mass shootings and domestic terrorism in the United States today?
According to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, there have been 251 mass shootings in the U.S. in 2019, and they define a shooting as anyone in which at least four people are shot, not counting the shooter, in the same incident. That could include cases where we think of it as urban kind of street violence or things like that, and not necessarily the sort of premeditated where usually white shooter stands up. But like, obviously these things are happening more often. They are a relatively small part of the number of overall gun deaths in America, which average about 33,000. But obviously the way to think about it is in the frame, maybe not obviously to me, in the frame of terrorism. I, by the way, don't like the modifier domestic before terrorism. Terrorism is terrorism. And whether it's domestic or international seems like about the eighth most important modifier. But you have someone with an expressly political motivation who is trying to instill fear through violence that stretches beyond the death toll from the incident alone. And so that's the angle that's a little bit different here. And like, to kind of like, to Beto's statement, for example, and you had several candidates who were like swearing about this, and I'm usually kind of in other contexts in favor of more swearing in politics. If you want my vote, swear more. But it is like a what the kind of moment, right? Because you have two ingredients here that are very, very important. One is that in the U.S. we have easier access to guns, and two is that you have a revival of white supremacism, which sometimes is aided and abetted by rhetoric from the president. And like, we can talk about how different solutions might be more difficult, or the contextual factors, or economic anxiety, or whatever, right? But like, but those have to be the first two things you mention. It's kind of obvious, right? And so if we're kind of dancing around it, and if people in the media are afraid to say that outright, instead they try to kind of, they know that's right, but they have to launder that through asking a Democratic legislator because they don't want to seem to, they're not both sidesy. I mean, it is kind of like a what the f- kind of moment.
I think actually the media has been, or many outlets in the media have been pretty frank about the—
That has changed. Yeah, I agree.
And that goes to Claire's point about, unfortunately, we've had enough of these mass shootings since the Gifford shooting that the media has had practice and just repetition of, just frankly, people are way more comfortable, including us, going to the politics, the political implications of these shootings more quickly after, which we think is a good thing.
And it's, you know, it's interesting because when was Columbine, 1999? I mean, that was, listen, I wasn't a sentient adult. I was a kid, but I remember it. And I remember people talking about video games was certainly a part of it, right? The culture, blah, blah, blah. But as the conversation has evolved over the past 20 years, it has turned into people explicitly tying it to the NRA and NRA policies. And now we're at this, the president's rhetoric kind of stage of things. I want to go back, though, for a second to the media thing. And I do think you are right, Micah, that we are more straightforward in our coverage about here's the materials, these things are connected. You know, there's a lot of really good in-depth writing and research that goes into it. And a lot of my colleagues here have done really good work on that. You should check out our guns project from a couple years ago, where we go really in depth to that. You know, the not to blame everything on Twitter or whatever, but like a lot of the like the soundbite culture of political media or the Twitter culture of political media, like that doesn't necessarily lend itself well to the nuance to say like, it's a hard thing to say, like the words you're saying could potentially be causing murderous events, right? That's an that's a big thing to say.
Yeah.
And it's a big thing to digest. And it's hard. It's like, I mean, I'm not sure where I'm going here necessarily, but like the trying to get a soundbite out of the presidential candidate about this really massive issue is kind of a rough situation to be in.
No, and the reaction I think is in part, the media will, some reporters will sometimes ask candidates like factual questions in order to do what Nate said, which is like you put you launder the opinion through one side or the other. But again, I think many outlets, including many major outlets, have been pretty good about being straightforward about this. Although that said, the conversation obviously hasn't come that far because we still have, mostly coming from Republicans, people pointing to video games and people pointing to...
And Trump did that in his response this morning.
It's almost so stupid that it's like not even worth pointing out how stupid it is, right? Like with the video games.
What thing. Okay.
I mean, you know me. I don't suffer fools lightly. And the video game argument is just so incredibly bullshit.
Yeah, but some people believe it, and I think you have... I think.
But if you believe that, then I think you're beyond persuasion, because it's so stupid that like your brain is addled by partisanship or stupidity, and I'm not sure that we're going to help you out. I mean, obviously, like... you know,
and it's worth saying that there has been research done on this topic that shows that there's not a connection
between television violence,
video games violence, and mass shootings.
I don't co-sign your statement, though, that we shouldn't go through the steps of proving to people or consistently slamming their heads against the wall and saying, no, these aren't connected.
We should recognize when powerful people are acting in bad faith.
Of course,
this is a complex problem. Why are we trying to find simple solutions?
Listen, Nate, of course you should, and of course you should call politicians out. But also, I think being repetitious in the way that you cover these events and continuously saying to the American public, not just disingenuous politicians, no, video games aren't connected. Let's talk about the root causes. That's not a futile act, right?
Okay. See, I agree with that. And let me actually add one other thing, which is the idea that video games are linked. Research has shown there's not a link. So, like, let's be super clear about that. But, like, I'm not sure it's a stupid idea. Like, have you played some of these video games?
Not crazy to say.
You know where they play a lot of video games? I think per capita the highest spending is in South Korea.
No, I'm not arguing there's a link.
You know
link.
Which
I'm
country has very few mass shootings? South Korea.
He's saying just don't dismiss that people could be persuaded the idea that having violence in media in general, having violence in video games, having a bunch of people play violent games, that people might be persuaded by that idea. We know from the research that it's not true, but let's move on from this specific part of the conversation.
Okay.
But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right. We have said that Democrats have been somewhat straightforward about connecting the rhetoric of the president and the attack in El Paso specifically. How much does this event, conversations about white supremacy, white nationalism, Trump's rhetoric, mass shootings, gun violence, how much does that play into Democrats' message to the public, if we're going to be kind of explicitly political here? Because after 2016, I think there was some reticence among Democrats to talk about quote-unquote identity politics.
I think Charlottesville changed that a lot. And I think you see Biden brings up Charlottesville a lot. And that's part of his argument to say, look at who, not just look at these terrible people in Charlottesville, but also look at the president vouching for these terrible people. And it's part of his whole, the country's on a wrong track and I'm the one to take on Trump thing. So I think that it has been talked about a lot. The presidential debates are notable for the sections of the debates that have focused on race. People talk about white supremacy in the United States, right? Like, it's a pretty, I do think that the Democrats are using that phrase, white supremacy. I think people, it, probably in the past few years, it has been used so much more and in a different, I think in a different way than most people have understood white supremacy in recent decades, right? Which is, people tended to think of white supremacy as the KKK lynching people and burning crosses. And they didn't think of it maybe necessarily by like a dictionary definition of white supremacy, which would be systemic racism and the belief that whites are, whether you're burning crosses or, you know, putting in poll taxes or whatever it is, an institutional privileging of whites over people of other races. And I think we are using that term white supremacy much, 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 much more in the context of regular everyday politics and calling things out. And that's been interesting to watch in the Democratic debates, because it doesn't just have to do with political violence. It kind of goes into the rhetoric and some of the other systemic things that Democrats are now pointing to and saying we need to change that.
Is it, you know, maybe we can't answer this question, but in watching interviews with Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, and Julian Castro over the weekend, some were more or less willing to tie the president's comments to the violence, right? Julian Castro said there's one person who's responsible for this attack. It's the shooter. Now, of course, this happens in an environment where the president is saying these kinds of things. Maybe Beto took a stronger stance in connecting the two. Is it wrong or bad politics to basically say the president is responsible for attacks like this on the Democrats' part?
Bad politics in what sense? I mean,
Because as we read, you can't, it's kind of like climate change, right? You can't say that storm was caused by climate change, but you can say,
I mean,
climate
change is real. You've had a lot of the Democrats kind of say expressly that they think the president is a racist. Beto was one of them, if I'm not mistaken. And you've had, you know, Joe Biden kind of launch his campaign around Charlottesville, so supposedly he's the most prudent and moderate candidate of the major candidates in the race, but he's willing to kind of go there as well. I mean, look, to some extent, you're going to have a process where you probably have some candidates emphasize gun violence more. I have some thoughts about who that might be based on who said more this weekend and whose communities were targeted. But to some extent, Democratic voters will signal in various ways how much they want to prioritize gun control and gun policy versus other issues, right?
I think someone like Castro, who maybe didn't call it out as explicit, what was his statement, Galen? He said that the shooter himself was responsible for it.
Jake Tapper asked him right. A similar question to what Beto had been asked about the relationship between Trump's rhetoric and the shooter. And he made very clear, you know, this is the shooter's fault.
Right. And I think that that's, I hate to call, like, an old school response. I hate to call it this, but because obviously these mass shootings are, you know, with these high capacity guns are happening much more often. And I think in the past, the reaction used to be really focused on the people who died, right? That was the initial first couple days of coverage. And I think we have a little bit jumped to, not wrongly necessarily, the systemic causes of it. I am a bit sympathetic to Castro's response being so, this is a shooter's fault. In some ways, I think that that's an effort to focus it on the specific incident, the people who died. You know, frankly, I have some personal experience with people politicizing an incident of personal violence and making it about something more. And I'm kind of sympathetic to that on some level, the idea that I don't see a ton of the same kind of thing of like, these are the people who died. We're going to do a long form thing about their lives. Like, it does seem to move, understandably, to the political part of the conversation. But in some ways, I'm sympathetic to politicians who respond by saying, this is, for right now, this shooter's fault. Let's talk about this community. It's an unrealistic expectation, I think, to think that we're gonna have the day to be like, well, you know, what the hell? All these people died. We live in 2019. We live in a presidential election season. Let's not be like Pollyannish about the fact that it's obviously going to be tied to politics. But I do think Castor's response is kind of old school and also a little understandable.
Well, and he did warn about like, quote, a toxic brew of white nationalism.
Sure,
so yeah. It wasn't like he was like
totally writing it off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The other thing is, I'm going to be interested to see which candidates. So there are two. There are a lot of things going on here, right? But two of them are, in terms of issues in the political realm, guns and then white nationalism, white supremacy. And it'll be interesting to see which candidates lean more into the guns part of this and which lean more into the race part of this, into the white supremacy part of this, or which, you know, tie them together. And I'm not sure which of those is like the better political move, to be crass, but...
And there was some talk about Trump this morning in his press conference that people are saying, oh, he's going to call for
universal background checks.
And it didn't happen. It could.
Well, he said
something like, whatever will work.
And in a tweet this morning, he suggested that background checks be tied somehow to immigration reform, which it is weird that Trump can't sometimes even do the minimum to say, like, let's focus on background checks and have a modest background check bill and like lobby for it with the GOP Congress and not tie it into something more complicated. Like, he can't even do that simple stuff or refuses, not can't, won't, right? There's always
He did bump stocks. He banned bump stocks.
Okay.
That's something.
Can I read the part where he said we can never, thoughts and prayers basically, Republicans and Democrats must come together and get strong background checks, perhaps marrying this legislation with desperately needed immigration reform. By the way, he also goes on to, he says, the media has a big responsibility to life and safety in our country. Fake news has contributed greatly to the anger and rage that has built up over many years. So,
and the shooter used the phrase, by the way, fake news in his manifesto.
But
that was on Twitter, by the way. That was not his teleprompter.
Well, that's correct. But that's what's so interesting is he tweeted it out this morning. And then I was in a meeting and they were saying, oh, apparently he's going to call for background checks in the speech. And I put it in Slack. And Galen, understandably, you were like, well, he did that in Twitter this morning. But the reason I was pointing it out is like what he puts on Twitter and frankly what he kind of said in the speech, it's just so meaningless. So part of what I was interested in is if he says the same thing on Twitter that he says in the speech, which is scripted and which he stayed on prompter for, you could tell, right? Mm-hmm. Then it was like, okay, Trump, Twitter, and his staff, the speech, are at least on the same page here and maybe agree.
But it didn't seem that way.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And he did say in that speech, quote, in one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. Again, not what he said on Twitter, so what he was reading off the teleprompter.
But to Nate's point, that verges on gaslighting, right? Because the other things he has said, up to and including his tweets that day, are so discordant with that.
And that is one thing where we're talking about the press getting smarter. I do think that, like, you don't see people saying, oh, Trump has pivoted toward a new blah, blah, right?
No, and, like, you don't see that.
Because a very large percentage of the time, either when he has a moment where he acts like a more typical, soothing, reassuring, angry as needed president, are followed usually 24 or 48 hours later where he gets caught up in some dispute and winds up undermining the entire thrust of that more olive branchy version of Trump.
And the view that Trump is racist is now a majority opinion.
A narrow minority. Like 52% of Americans, I think, say he is racist. 45% say no. And
it's still like a partisan.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think it cuts mostly along partisan lines.
Wow. It is striking that that's a poll question.
Yeah. So, I mean, specifically, I'm looking at like, this Quinnipiac poll asked, do you think Trump is racist? 51% said yes, 45% said no. There are some unknowns there, or they don't know. then asked whether Trump's immigration policies are about a sincere interest in controlling our border or racism. 49% said sincere interest. 41% said racism. So I think that also shows us that the racism question, whether or not you think Trump is racist, is not just partisan. Because when asked about his immigration policies, people are a little more nuanced about whether or not he's being sincere or whether or not it's racism. You don't get a majority of Americans saying that his immigration policies are rooted specifically in racism. But when we talk about what happens next politically, we've had this conversation before on this podcast about what happens after gun violence. Is there any reason to expect that we will see changing laws in the coming months?
I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. I mean, you saw they passed that bump stocks bill. You know, Democrats are calling on Mitch McConnell to call the Senate back from recess. Do I think that will happen? Probably not. I'd be surprised by that.
I mean,
but like in the next few months, could they pass like a lukewarm background checks bill? I don't think that's impossible. I'm not sure it's likely, but
I mean, yet again, you have a big divide between the House and the Senate, where in the House, obviously a big problem for the GOP was the suburban area swinging blue. Those areas are going to tend to prefer Democrats' policy on guns. And, you know, it's a big problem for Republicans. In the Senate, overwhelmingly disproportionately represented by rural states, and so it's a very different calculation. But yeah, look, again, there are, for a long time, the kind of belief was that, well, sure, most Americans want background checks and more gun control, but Republicans feel more strongly, conservatives feel more strongly about the issue. That polarity has shifted, I think, post-Parkland.
Yeah.
Where it's not clear. Actually, in the Gallup survey of midterm voters last year, I think more Democrats said gun control was a higher priority than Republicans did. And so that has shifted a lot. But again, a lot of policy would look very different if you didn't have a deliberate bias in the Senate toward rural states. And that really affects kind of where policy is.
The other thing I wouldn't be super surprised by is if they passed some type of this like red flag legislation, which Trump mentioned in his speech, which is you can go to court to sort of get someone's guns taken away or preempt their ability to buy a gun if they've
had interactions with the police.
Right. Or, you know, or some type of violence. There was a poll by our colleagues at ABC News and The Washington Post from last year that showed 83% of Republicans backed some type of that provision.
I think
so. That could happen.
I think, you know, Parkland, the I remember having a podcast with you guys after Parkland, and there was the big CNN town hall where, you know, you had a confrontation between Rubio and one of the students. Dana Lash from the NRA was on. It was a big deal, and I think in part because Americans react really strongly to shootings in schools. I mean, we saw it with Newtown when there were like essentially toddlers who were killed. So people, I think, do have really strong reactions to those school shootings. And my sense with all this stuff is that the smallest of nudges along the way, like each one kind of accumulates up together. So like, I think Micah might be right. Like maybe something will happen with background checks. Nate's also right that this is, you know, the gun issue because of the rural bias of the Senate does become just on some level, you're not going to get the huge change that Democrats want unless you change the makeup of that chamber. So to me, it feels like this nudging along at this really, really slow pace that's understandably disappointing for a lot of people.
Yeah. And the other part of this, you know, and just to contradict myself, you know, 80 something percent of Republicans might say they favor that type of law, that the red flag type of law. But like guns is so tied in with identity now, particularly partisan identity, but now add race in there. And I think obviously it wouldn't be surprising if you just saw a kind of hardening of the partisan lines and nothing gets done. That's probably the modal outcome here, right?
Yeah. I would maybe argue, though, that Republicans know that even if rural voters have an advantage in the Senate, if they want to be competitive in the House and in national elections, they do have to win back suburban voters. They can't just cede. I mean, look at the country broadly, you add up urban and suburban voters, and there's not that much of America left to vote for.
I mean,
right?
we'll talk about this in the next segment, right? But like the Republicans who know they have to appeal to suburbanites
are dropping out,
are leaving. Yeah.
But wouldn't that scare the Republican Party and therefore encourage them?
Galen, I take your strategic point, but also in some ways, I think it's the end of a Republican Party, right? Maybe a little bit from a strategic sense. It's like, well, we're not going to win those leaning Democratic districts anymore anyway, so let's play to the Trump message.
If you're on the battleship Trump, right, and you're the captain, you're on the battleship Trump, which has a lot of momentum toward all these things that you think are bad for the party. And furthermore, 3/4 of the crew are either true believers in Trumpism or are from districts that are very, very strongly Trump and are very rural, and therefore where your constituents might not like anything to limit availability of guns, right? That's a really, really, really hard ship to turn around. And I don't know. I mean, it's occurred to me this weekend, people are so short-term focused. There are lots of scenarios where Trump's presidency results in long-term disaster for Republicans. We don't know or not. We don't know, right? But like if you are having people like Will Herbert retire, we're blurring the next segment. So, but like this, there are lots of ways this could be.
Yeah, let's actually talk about that now, since we're already getting into it. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork spaces are designed to maximize workplace efficiency, employee effectiveness, team collaboration, and creativity. It's the perfect solution for medium, large, and enterprise businesses that intend to expand into new cities and continents with ease. Looking for an office with a view of Lima, London, Melbourne, or Mumbai? WeWork now has over 400 locations in 100 different cities worldwide. Membership plans are completely flexible, and workspaces are designed to grow with your team. WeWork's floor mapping technology is used to build out custom private floors for larger teams, perfectly designed to fit your business's continuously evolving needs. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you or learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Credit card bills. Every month, you get them, with multiple payments and multiple due dates. Wouldn't it be easier to just have one payment at a lower rate? You can with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. Plus, the rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and we just started the conversation about Republican retirements in the House and essentially Republican strategy going forward as a result of some of those retirements. Now, the news that we're reacting to is that one today, Kenny Marchant in Texas announced his retirement. But on top of that, last Thursday, Will Hurd, also a congressman from Texas, congressman from the border, actually, and the lone black Republican congressman left in the House, also announced his retirement. On top of that, we had some other recent retirement announcements, including Martha Roby. At this point, 9 Republicans have said that they are retiring so far in 2019. Let's just begin with putting that number in context. Is 9 retirements a lot for Republicans so far this year?
So at this point, as of August 1st, so not quite the same, but almost the same date, 2 years ago, you had 11 Republican retirements at that point. But remember, last year was like a legendarily kind of very high number of retirements for Republicans. And so the fact that they're almost on pace to last year is not good for the GOP, especially given that they now have fewer people, period. So it's a bad sign. At least a couple of these Texas districts look like they're going to be quite competitive. And that's it. You know, the Texas angle is interesting unto itself.
Right. Both Will Hurd and Kenny Marchant come from competitive districts in Texas.
Yeah, look, political winds can shift quickly, and a lot of newly elected Democrats that were elected in a very blue year in 2018 would be inherently vulnerable in 2020. But if you have all these remaining GOP suburban incumbents dropping out, to be replaced by someone who's more Trumpian, then what are the GOP's odds of retaking the House? This is material stuff, right? Both for like the immediate impact in districts like Will Herr's, which is probably now a lean Democratic district, and in terms of like the signal it gives for other retirements and also kind of candidate quality. So it's not just who retires, but also where you're going to like actually get a well-heeled, say, state senator. Are they going to run for the House now, knowing they're going to spend the next 2 years dealing with Trump's rhetoric, knowing that they're going to probably be in the minority? You know, maybe not. And candidates matter a lot in these races. And so if I were Republicans wanting to take over the House, I'd be very, very, very worried about this.
Well, and the reason which you kind of got at, Nate, that it's especially worrying for Republicans is it's like doubly bad. It's both bad as a signal in that you have these members who know their districts really well, who are getting polling, who are talking to people and clearly looking around and being like, ooh, 2020 is going to be rough on me. Maybe it's better if I just kind of like pack my bags and go. And it's bad in the way Nate just described, which is there's an advantage to being incumbent. A lot of these people had run before. It will be hard for the party to replace them with a candidate of equal or better quality.
And also just, I mean, I think some of the stories in various outlets that have talked about these retirements have made the point that the people who are retiring, the kinds of districts that they're coming from, you know, the fact that you might have to, that you're asked about the president's comments all the time, the fact that you might have to, you know, defend his comments on things you probably don't agree with,
yeah,
on a variety of issues. I'm sure that there's some sort of, you know, there's also like a job quality of life aspect to this, right? I think you saw this with Bob Corker's retirement in Tennessee, Senator Bob Corker's retirement. I think at the end of the day, he was just sort of sick of being, I mean, there were certainly electoral arguments to be made, but it's also like you didn't want to fight for, you know, a year and a half to do something that maybe wasn't actually all that great day to day to begin with in a Trump era.
Do you remember when Trey Gowdy announced his retirement and then went on Vice and gave one of the most blunt political interviews I've ever seen, in which he was just like, honestly, it sucks. I didn't enjoy this. I came here with my idealism and it was just totally squashed and I'm leaving unhappy about the experience.
I actually have like this is an earnest statement, but like I do think that there is a certain point past which some people should not go in public service. Ambition isn't a strange beast, but like a lot of people, you know, get really into local government and they're on the school board and they're on city council and then maybe they run for state rep, but then they're always like, what about Congress? I mean, what's wrong with being a state rep or a city councilor or the mayor of a small town? Like, good governance can happen on a small level and you don't have to like sell your soul.
Your name in flashing lights, Claire.
Anyway, so I know that there are probably a lot of local politicians who listen to this podcast, and I mean this in all sincerity, and I thought about this.
Stay where you are.
I thought about this a lot. Why not stay where you are and like be really good at what you do for the people you actually know?
Lower your ambitions.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I do it every day.
One thing I wanted to mention, Micah, you were saying that there's two ways in which this is bad for Republicans. It's materially in that, you know, incumbents can do better, but also the message that it sends. There's one more notable aspect here, which is that, as we already mentioned, Will Herr was the only black Republican in the House. On top of that, according to Politico, there are now more men named Jim in the House than Republican women running for re-election. This is somewhat of a hollowing out of demographics with whom the Republican Party already does poorly. And we've talked about the gender gap before on this podcast. You know, the gender gap can potentially be fine if you're doing as well with men as you are doing poorly with women. But once, you know, for example, Democrats start doing better with men but keep doing as well with women, you're screwed and you have to make up ground with women. Does this also pose a challenge on that front?
Yeah, I mean, it's the continuation of a long-term thing. But the Republican Party is mostly white, disproportionately male, disproportionately old. Those are like the defining features of the party. That has become increasingly true over the past couple decades. And there is a self-fulfilling cycle here where if you don't have a woman in the room, if you don't have a person of color in the room, if you don't have someone under 50 in the room, then it's hard for the end product of whatever people are cooking up in that room to appeal to those people, right? Or to even speak to those people, to be relevant to those people. Yeah, this is a long-term problem for the for the Republican Party.
So, okay, so if women are the new swing voters, if like white college-educated women and white non-college-educated women are kind of the new swing voters, there is a real big strategic argument from the Republican side of things to start to think smartly about ways to pitch your policies to women. There was an interesting moment on the stage. This is obviously the Democrats, but Andrew Yang talked about his universal basic income plan through the eyes of, we should give stay-at-home mothers and fathers, but mothers was what he said, we should give them money for the work they do. That's an interesting way to frame it, right? And to me, it is fascinating to watch the GOP not have a consistent message to women. And even in the Democratic primary, you see all these new issues coming up that refine the way you talk to women politically that are super interesting. And I'd bet my bottom dollar that they come because more of the candidates are women. Kamala Harris's plan for pay equity, where the burden falls on a company that's not paying women as well as men, not the individual woman. Kirsten Gillibrand saying that we should have a plan for IVF for poor women, not just for wealthy women. So there are, this is just to bolster your point, but to me, it doesn't make sense that the Republicans aren't thinking more in a more fine-tuned way about how to get their policies across in a relatable way to women specifically, because they're the swing voters.
But I mean, it makes perfect sense. There's not many women in the room. So it's like,
yeah, no, I know, but it's
you have to overcome, without more representation in the room. First of all, there's ignorance, right? So there's, you don't know what you don't know. But speaking as a white man, I can say this with lots of confidence. You don't know what you don't know, right? So it's like there's a constant process of,
if you don't know, now you know,
of asking questions and being and learning, right? Well, past that, there's also apathy, and then there's like outright hostility. You have to overcome all, you know, it's a, anyway.
I do want to bring it back again to a point that I always raise in these contexts. Maybe you guys are tired of hearing about it, right? But it's about the structural advantages that you have toward having a coalition of like older white working class voters in the Senate and the Electoral College. To some extent, the GOP is responding to that. If you can imagine that everything was determined by the popular vote, then as bad a year as the GOP had in the House, if California had, you know, 25 times more senators than Wyoming, they'd be affected there as well. And if they had the popular vote, they would not control the presidency right now. And so a lot of things would be quite different. But I do wonder if it's like a kind of bargain with the devil in the long run.
Because with very few exceptions, men and women populate the United States in equal proportion.
I'm not talking about men and women. I'm talking about white people versus non-white people. And to some extent, rural people versus urban people. And, you know, to some extent, Texas is like a little bit like kind of when the iceberg starts to melt, where when Texas begins to go purple, then all of the advantages the GOP has from having at least an electoral college. In the Senate, they kind of have like there's a permanent built-in and rather profound advantage toward whichever party performs strongly in rural areas. That's not going to change unless more states are added and therefore have senators.
Rural states urbanize.
Or the Dakotas combine, right?
Or the coalitions change.
But hey, like, also, what if all of the people in Nebraska start living in Lincoln? Who knows?
Or what if we got rid of North Dakota from the Union?
Combine the Dakotas.
This doesn't account for Republicans' difficulty with women. And let me just read this one more quote from a New York Times article about the retirements. This is what it says. Representative Susan Brooks of Indiana, the head of recruitment for the party's campaign committee, had been tasked with replenishing the ravaged ranks of Republican women. She announced in June that she would retire, an indication of the long odds of that effort. So literally, the person who was tasked with replenishing the House with Republican women retired.
Perry and I worked on this big piece we did a while ago, headlined Why the Republican Party Elects So Few Women. And part of the issue is that the system is biased against women in a number of ways, right? And so to elect women, you can't do nothing. You have to actively try to elect women. If you just let the system play out, the system will favor men. Women are less likely to run. If they run, they're just as likely to win. But there are a million impediments to women running. So in other words, you have to actively put pressure on the system to elect women. Democrats have that in the form of, most importantly, like Emily's List, right? Republicans don't have the equivalent of that, right? Now, you can ask why.
They literally do, but in terms of strength, probably is not equivalent, right? Like, they have Susan B. Anthony's list. They have some groups
like
that.
And they have like Maggie's list, but it's not.
It's often contingent on a particular issue.
And it's not of magnitude or scale or whatever. It just doesn't have nearly the power. And there are reasons for that, right? Republicans in general, I think part of their ideology puts less emphasis on aspects of identity, right? Mm-hmm. And so the party in general is less comfortable, I think, in a real way and opposed in a real way to actively trying to elect this identity or that identity, right? But then without that, you know, you kind of let the system run its course, and that'll give you disproportionately men. There's obviously also just a question of, like, the Republican Party is on the wrong side of some issues that women are on the other side of.
I was talking about earlier how white women voters are becoming more of a swing constituency, and I think white college-educated women were trending that way pre this midterm, but then we saw white non-college-educated women in this past midterms going a little bit more in the Democratic column. I think it's interesting because, you know, I was talking to someone about this recently, and they made the interesting point that, in their view, the way that you, as a Republican, turn those white non-college-educated women against you is you make them believe that you are the party of rich people and taking away their birth control, right? The idea that those working-class white women or non-college-educated white women, they're not evangelicals. They might believe racist things. They might live in largely white areas. But culturally, in some ways, they are liberal, and they don't like rich people, right? And so the idea that as you become a more male-centric party, that really, a conservative male party, that sort of key point of taking away, it's not just sexual freedom, but economic freedom via the ability to family plan, that's actually sort of a potentially damaging long-term perception of your party. And so I thought that was an interesting point, which is, like, those women might vote for Trump in a national election, but they might be irritated at their congressperson on a, you know, in a midterm election or whatever, and they might say, I'm going the other way. I'm balancing out my ticket.
All right. Well, we will see what happens in 2020 if that...
Won't we?
We will.
I mean, that's how we should end every podcast.
We'll see what happens.
And we'll check in with you in November of 2020.
We're going on vacation, folks. Just to wrap up, I do want to ask, before we end the podcast, the last time we spoke, we were in Detroit. It was Thursday, right after the two Democratic primary debates, and we had only had one poll out post-debates. We have a little more data now. So, Nate, what does that tell us about how the American public reacted to the Democratic debates in Detroit?
Well, it's fascinating because nothing seems to have happened, really.
That was my hot take.
Yeah. There has been...
That was everyone's hot take.
A little polling. It's just fascinating. There has been little polling, which maybe suggests that Harris is down another point or two and Warren is up another point or two and everyone else seems to be pretty
steady.
What
about Sanders? Wasn't Sanders doing a little better?
Maybe up a point or two.
Yeah. What about, remember Claire predicted that John Delaney would surge by, what did you say, Claire? It was like 8 or 9 percentage points?
I rarely assign numbers to anything.
That's how you knew I was lying. did Delaney move at all, Nate?
No, I mean, these,
you know who did?
People
Tulsi.
Are predicting.
Yes, he did.
What about Delaney? Booker?
Booker was up about 2. Tulsi was up about 2.
I mean, which polls are you guys looking at?
Yeah, in one poll that I looked at.
I don't know. I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics Morning Consult, Harvard Harris.
Clearly, this debate is not going to be a major... I'm sorry for the phrase. A major game changer, I don't think. But we'll see. We haven't had a traditional high-quality live telephone poll post-debates yet, as of this taping.
There's not going to be any change.
Those polls... Well, Micah, don't hold your... effing horses.
We should make a t-shirt for our 538 store that just says live polls and it has the exclamation point and it's got the sort of, you know, like they would have live girls.
Live, like that's good. Club. That's really good. Yeah.
Wait, but at this point, wouldn't we start getting, with incoming polls, wouldn't we start getting into territory where voters are also, or Americans in general, Democratic voters, are also reacting to how those politicians reacted to the
I mean, the politicians
shootings?
Who are more... forceful and reacting might get more of an advantage. I mean, it sounds callous to, like, predict who's going to go up or down, but, like,
Well, I'm more just saying that the effects of the debate could be muddled in all of that, considering that they're now reacting to more than one
thing. There is like a real struggle here among the Democrats where there is a group of candidates who sort of want to talk about like economic justice and distribution of wealth and healthcare on the one hand, and there's like another nexus where people want to talk about cultural issues slash how terrible Trump is slash race on the other hand, and those kind of clusters go together, and you can kind of go through one by one and kind of figure out which candidates are in which cluster and want to talk about what, right? And
and some are in both, is that fair to say?
Who's in both?
Elizabeth Warren?
No, Elizabeth Warren's clearly not in the culture and race cluster.
Wait, what were the two clusters?
She talks a lot about race.
Well, because she's a good politician, but
I mean, she,
Elizabeth Warren,
when during the debates, she was one of the people who mentioned Trump the most.
Then why are her supporters so white? I don't think she's one of those candidates who, if you're being callous, is happy for the conversation to turn to those issues versus issues like healthcare, which is still the number one issue for Democrats and was the focus in some ways of the debates. If you're being callous, then like, that's not her comparative advantage. People come to her for like kind of wonky left policy solutions. And like, I think it was Marianne Williams said, who says like racism is like not an issue where the wonks are going to like have a lot to say.
I don't know. Having watched her on the stump, it seems like she talks about this stuff pretty often and openly.
I think she often ties race to economic issues, which I think is interesting. Or, you know, like she talks about plans to end sort of or to give additional funds to areas that have been historically redlined. She has, you know, we want to build up black wealth. When she talks about race, she smartly ties it to economic issues.
Which I guess is why I would say it's both clusters is how I would.
I think it's a little generous. I think if you look at the way that like what black Democrats are.
Well, now
he's
just going to dig. Now it's two against one.
I'm saying like, maybe she talks about race in a way that appeals to white voters.
Maybe to the slice that of the Democratic primary electorate that is the woke white people, right? The increasingly liberal, particularly on race, segment of the primary, which tends to be, college-educated white people or, you know, wealthier white people.
All right. Well, with that, we are going to wrap up today's podcast. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And before we go, I will mention that we are trying something new here on the 538 Politics podcast. We are videotaping our podcast, and it is
moving pictures.
You make it seem like we like invented this new form of communication.
I mean, for me, it is a very new form of communication as an audio person, but ABC News Live is working with us and taping our politics podcast and then putting it up on the ABC News Live channel. You can stream it when you
but not live.
ABC News Live. You cannot stream it live.
That would be a disaster for reasons you will never find out, thanks to our editors.
Yes. ABC News Live is where you can check it out. It'll be out the day after we put the podcast out. All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.